All right, it is Tuesday. It is relatively 4:30 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. And, of course, we know what that means. It is time for In the Cage with Bards, Vancouver's only show dedicated to the sport of mixed martial arts. And because City Hall has not yet revoked any rights to my name, I am still Carlin Bardsley. And we're in the midst of a heat wave here in Vancouver, and things are getting hot in the MMA world as well. Big news from Ontario, as the provincial government there has decided to legalize and regulate the sport of mixed martial arts. Tom Wright, the ex-CFL commissioner and now director of the UFC's Canadian operations, said the organization has made a significant commitment to Canada by opening a Toronto office and is prepared to hold 3 or 4 pay-per-view events in major Canadian cities every year, with the first event in Ontario likely to be held at Toronto's Sky Dome in the spring. I know technically it's called the Rogers Centre now, but it'll always be Skydome to me. Beyond the pay-per-view events, the UFC is also looking at staging several Spike TV Fight Night events in cities such as Kingston, Ottawa, London, and Hamilton. In addition to the UFC holding events, smaller promotions are ecstatic about the news as well. Maximum Fighting Championship's Mark Pavlich, who wanted to stage a show here at the PNE until City Hall's intransigence on the matter convinced him otherwise, is looking to book events in the province, as well as the Warrior One promotion headed by Jack Bateman. W1 currently runs about a half dozen shows per year in Quebec and other provinces, and Bateman says the business plans call for 4 to 5 large shows in Toronto and other major Ontario cities, plus a challenger league that would focus on local athletes and run as many small towns in the province as possible. Any place that has a AAA hockey team, basically, we're going there, says Bateman. Kudos to Tom Wright, Mark Ratner, and the rest of the UFC team for working with the Ontario government and showing them that our sport is safe, popular, and perhaps just as important, economically advantageous. Tom Wright may want to turn his attention here to BC now, as beyond the lunacy of the saga of Vancouver City Council versus MMA, we've got another hurdle that's popped up. The BC Medical Association held a caucus meeting and passed a resolution stating that it wants the sport banned in Canada, and now will be pitching that idea to the Canadian Medical Association at their annual general meeting. If that resolution passes, they will then lobby the federal government to ban the sport nationwide. The BCMA's president, Dr. Ian Gillespie, says, We know there are a number of serious injuries that can occur, including broken limbs, lacerations, and brain damage. Why they're choosing to focus on MMA and not other contact sports which carry similar risks, well, that's anyone's guess. He also adds, it's our understanding that what distinguishes MMA from boxing, for instance, is the use of various techniques that aren't limited to punching. So anything beyond punching may be out of their scope. For example, he continues, MMA allows a fighter to attack an opponent while down, and we believe those things increase the risk of serious injury. So again, it looks like a misunderstanding of how ground combat works is what is taking the toll to MMA here. And I don't know, does anyone else feel like they're in a time warp and gone back to 1995? Maybe it's just me. This completely flies in the face of a study done by Johns Hopkins University, which found that the overall rate of injury in MMA is no worse than in other combat sports, including boxing, and that the mortality rate is much less. MMA knockout rates are also lower than boxing, which suggests a reduced rate of brain injury in MMA by comparison. Michael Smith in The Province, he wrote an excellent rebuttal piece after interviewing Dr. Gillespie, where the good doctor appeared to lack any sort of knowledge about the sport that he wants to ban. He admitted that he has never actually seen an MMA competition, and when asked how many ring deaths there had been compared to a sport such as boxing, his answer was, I actually don't know. So, again, this is another situation like what happened with North Vancouver City Council, dissolving the athletic commission there, and... again, not having actually seen the sport. Why is it so much to ask that people actually see the sport before making a judgment on that? It seems, intuitive to me. Admittedly, I'm not the smartest guy in the world. I'll never claim to be. But if I was to want to ban, let's say golf. Why not? Something pretty benign, right? But I had never actually seen golf. I just knew it was guys running around in the grass carrying a bunch of clubs around, and I found that dangerous. Wouldn't you want me to actually see what golf is before I decided I wanted to ban it? Maybe not. I don't know. Well, at any rate, in an attempt to help Dr. Gillespie, here are the numbers. Since MMA was introduced to North America in 1993, the total number of fatalities has been 2. One in Texas in 2007, and the unfortunate case this year of a debuting fighter in South Carolina. The total number of deaths in a major promotion that is sanctioned by a well-run athletic commission? 0. Now, for the sport of boxing, there were 70 reported fatalities from 1998 to 2006, averaging out to about 80 a year. Extrapolating those numbers, that work out to about 144 deaths over an 18-year span. And looking at the Catastrophic Sports Injury Research Study that was conducted by the University of North Carolina, we can also get a breakdown of other sports. Football had 104 deaths and 531 non-fatal and serious injuries. Soccer had 7 deaths and 10 serious injuries. Cheerleading had 3 deaths and 102 serious injuries. Basketball and hockey both had 2 deaths and 17 serious injuries. And gymnastics, the silent killer, had 1 death and 12 serious injuries. So based purely on the numbers, it would appear that one is more likely to die from cheerleading than in a sanctioned, regulated MMA bout. But yet, I see no one trying to get cheerleading banned. That's weird, huh? Dr. Gillespie has yet to respond to an invitation to appear on this show, but hopefully, you know, he'll get around to it after he goes, you know, does the rest of the tour. I caught him on CBC, and, you know, the CBC radio guy that was interviewing him, I don't want to say, he was an expert on the sport. He clearly was limited in his knowledge, but even he seemed to have the good doctor on the back step with regards to why, in fact, it is so important to ban this sport nationwide and keep us sensible, sane Canadians, you know, keep us from doing terrible things. You know, also, I also want to make clear that Dr. Gillespie has yet to respond, but if any cheerleaders want to come on this show and debate the safety of cheerleading versus mixed martial arts, I am more than willing to do that also. So look out for that. Who knows? We could have a cheerleader as a guest on In the Cage with Bards next week, and I know you wouldn't want to miss that. Also, this past weekend, Powerhouse World Promotions War on the Mainland show took place. Its main event being the Maniac, Tim Sylvia, taking on Paul the Headhunter Buentello. Sylvia and Buentello, they really went at it for the first minute and a half or so, and then it turned into another case of Tim Sylvia using his weight to lean on Buentello and really sap the energy before clipping him with a bunch of leg kicks and a right uppercut, which eventually ended the fight in the second round. Sylvia won the Powerhouse World Promotions World Heavyweight Championship due to that fight, which was interesting, as the always pudgy Sylvia weighed in at about 275 pounds, missing the heavyweight cutoff by a full 10 pounds, but yet it was for the title anyway. Oh, well. Another action on the card, Jens Pulver. He continued his Please Don't Make Me Retire tour, lost his 6th straight, and also lost in under a minute due to guillotine choke, which has been his habit lately. I love watching Jens from the early days. He was a fantastic athlete in his day, but now it's getting to the point where I think we have to, you know, maybe Dr. Gillespie can talk to him and realize that maybe there is another career choice for him out there. Also on the card, Matt Horwich became the promotion's middleweight champion, defeating a former UFC top middleweight contender Talis Latis in the 4th round. And Horwich was super excited after the fight. He gave this interview with MMA Heat's Karen Bryant, which showed just how excited he was and just how versatile this man's vocabulary is. Let's check it out.
For MMA Heat, I'm here with the new PWP middleweight champ, Matt Horwich. Congratulations.
Thanks so much. I want to thank everyone for coming out. Thank Powerhouse for giving me the opportunity. It's the biggest win of my life. I'm so stoked. It's a beautiful universe.
It is. Well, it was a beautiful fight. That 3rd round was incredible. You guys had so many great almost chokes, reversals. How did that feel for you?
Talis Latis is possibly my tough opponent yet, most likely. He fought Anderson Silva to the decision. That side choke was close. I knew he had a good side choke. I practiced defending it, and I was able to gut it out and get out and keep my faith and come back and get the win. All things are possible to them who believe, and we all have a big dream to follow, And it's a beautiful multiverse.
It is. Are you going to write a song about it?
Yeah, I'm working on a poem called Infinitely Accelerating Current of Creativity about the universe's expansion and relativity and how art and science and spirituality are all connected, flowing one quarter note to the next in music, one submission to the next or combo to the next in MMA, or one subatomic particle to the next in string theory and grand unified theory and quantum physics.
All right, well, no, it's actually, I was going to say, with MMA, there is that fluidity of the rolling, and there is that kind of great thing of the unity of the two bodies in there working together to this one, you know, one common outcome.
Yeah.
At the end, one wins and one loses, but you guys are working together toward this great thing at the end.
Yeah, the fight's never against Talos Latus or the other guy. The fight's against myself to smash through new limits and evolve mentally and spiritually and physically by the great spirit's grace, and keep growing in faith every fight, develop the kind of faith that can move mountains, and keep coming back with a better performance.
You have a great corner with Eddie Bravo and Connor Hoon, right?
Yeah, I'm blessed with the best team in the world to work with, the best coaches, Eddie Bravo and Chris Riley. It's just a great vibe, great energy. It's just awesome. Great to see BJ Penn here. BJ Penn is like the Geronimo of Islanders.
That's a great way to put it. That's a great way to put it. So what does a guy like you do to celebrate a win?
Well, I'm going to go drink some water, probably go out and say hi to everyone, celebrate with my wife and my team and family, get back in the gym Monday, get back training for the next fight, and keep coming back readier than ever.
Right. Well, congratulations to you, champ.
All right. Thanks so much, everyone. We're all born into a great story, and we all have a big dream to follow.
Wow, dude has an education, I'll
My
say
name's...
that much. Oh, man. Thanks again to Karen Bryant from MMA Heat for conducting that interview. And we, of course, look forward to Matt Horowitz's Infinitely Accelerating Current of Creativity, which I'm sure will be available at bookstores near you very soon. Okay, time to take a little break, and then when we come back, the man, the myth, the legend, El Wapo himself, Boss Rutan, joins In the Cage with Bards. We talk about a variety of subjects. Anything you get to talk to Boss about is always better than talking to anyone else, pretty much. So stay tuned for that. Boss Rutan after the break.
The Rio Theater is entering the third dimension with its brand new state-of-the-art 3D projector. Don't miss Piranha 3D at the Rio Theater.
1160 East Broadway commercial. For more info, go to riotheater.ca.
Here we are back on 101.9 CITR FM on In the Cage with Bards, and joining us today, one of the absolute legends of the game, El Wapo, Boss Rutan. What's new, Boss?
Nothing. I'm actually standing across the street in my car, looking at my daughter and her friend having an lemonade stand, so I'm I'm keeping my eye on them.
Oh, so
I'm alone nowadays, right?
You're the bouncer for the lemonade stand now?
That's what I am, all incognito.
Have you got the dark shades on in the whole bit?
No, I didn't do that because that's a little bit too much. My car also doesn't have the tinted windows and all that stuff because then I think you attract more attention than doing it without.
Always incognito.
There we go.
You began your MMA career in the Pancrase promotion in Japan with the likes of the Shamrocks, Mo Smith, Guy Mesker, and all the rest. How did you first become involved with Pancrase?
Well, I got a phone call, and it was weird because my wife actually predicted all this. She said, like, 4 months before the phone call, she was looking very weird at me, and I go, what's up? And she says, you're going to be a famous fighter in Japan. And I said, no, I'm not going to fight anymore, I told you. She says, no, you said that you're not going to fight in Holland anymore, but you're going to go to Japan. And 4 months later, I get a phone call, and normally I don't ever pick up the phone, and I had no voicemail because the thing was broke. There wasn't even a voicemail at the time. But I picked up, and they said, okay, you got to go tonight to Amsterdam. And that's I went to Amsterdam. It was the tryout. Funaki, Suzuki were there, the two head guys of Pancras.
Right.
They were looking for fighters, and I got in a scuffle, so to say, with one of the world champions from Rings organization. He tried to knock me out, so I knocked him out. And they were pointing at me, and they said, "We want him." That was it.
Excellent. After battling the best Pancras had to offer and becoming a three-time king of Pancras, you made the jump to the UFC. What was it at the time about the UFC that appealed to you? Because obviously it wasn't the juggernaut that it is today.
You know what it was, and you might laugh about this. I loved the entrance music of the UFC. Dum, 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 that thing. I go, man, that is so cool to come up with that, and the whole thing, the cage, and, you know, it was just cool stuff. So, yeah, that's why I wanted to go there. And I knew a whole bunch of guys from Pancras. They did really good in the UFC. I mean, we got Frank Shamrock, Guy Metzger, Ken Shamrock,
right.
Maurice Smith, as you mentioned. You know, there's a whole bunch of guys that came from Pancras, and they did really good in the UFC.
But that all came second to the gladiator music.
Yes, that, for real. And that was real. Really, people look at me always and you're kidding. I said, no, that's really. I really wanted to come up with that song because that was so cool. What I wanted to do originally, I had the Three Tenors, the DVD of the Three Tenors, Pavarotti and some other guys,
right.
And they sing that song, "Oh, I like to be in America," and it's like a 40-second little song, and it's really cool. And I figured, you know, I just came from Holland. And I said to Bob Myrowitz at the time, he was the owner, I said, man, put that 40-second clip in front of that cool music, you know, but they didn't want to do it. That was a shame, because that would have been awesome.
Yeah, you should have repitched that to Zuffo when they took over.
Yeah, I know. But, then at that time, my knees were not working with me anymore.
You knocked out Tsuyoshi Kosaka in your UFC debut, and then you took on Kevin Randleman and defeated him to become the UFC heavyweight champ. What was going through your mind as they put the belt around your waist?
That was kind of weird. There was a whole crazy thing because, you know, it was very controversial because I was the guy who was beat up. You know, yet then I won the fight, and the people go like, "Whoa, what's going on here?" And you know, but I, you know, after a so-so, there was a lot of going back and forth. I don't know anymore. It was my nose was busted. I lost a contact lens. The other eye was closed. I was swallowing my own blood. That was the worst thing in the whole fight because it was laying on my back, and because my nose was broke, I was swallowing my blood the whole time, and I had to throw up like in the corner. I put my finger in my throat so I could throw that blood out because it kept on coming.
Oh,
that
God.
Made me, that was annoying. It made me nauseous. But not afterwards, you know, I got all happy because Randleman even said, you know, he says, yeah, after the liver kick, I couldn't do anything anymore. And that's in that, you know, you see after 4 minutes, the rest of the fight, he throws maybe 5 punches. So, but it was at that time because he went back and forth, and you know, I don't think that it was a real super experience of wow, I got the belt like that. I wanted to finish him, and what happened was I went high altitude training for the first time in my life, and there's some guys, and apparently I'm one of those guys that backfires. What happens is that you build up lactic acid real bad.
Mm-hmm.
And Dwayne Ludwig lives in Colorado. When he comes here training, then suddenly you see also he's shaking his arms all the time. I said, man, your forearms, they're like cramping, right? He said, yeah. I said, I had the same thing with the Randleman fight. And I found that out on the day before because I was, you know, Alan Gowis was there and he attacked me for fun. And I started, you know, a little wrestling with him. And I locked my whole body locked up. So with that in my mind, I went to the fight. I go, holy shit, man, if this is going to happen in the fight, you know, that's why you see me in the fight slowly but surely. I start realizing, okay, it's okay, it's okay, and then I start picking it up. But it was an experience, let me tell you that.
Yeah, that was a very close decision. Some people even thought Randleman won that. The two of you even joked about it later on in Pride. What do you say to people who still think that Randleman won that fight?
You know, it's like... I said it like this. If this would have been a three-round fight, the first round he would have won, I would have won the other two fights. And actually, if it was a title fight, because it was, what was it? It was a 21-minute fight.
Mm-hmm.
A 21-minute fight. Now, if you would divide it over like 7 rounds of 3 minutes, the first 3 minutes, that was him. He took it to me, broke my nose, and that was, after that, every round is mine. He takes a takedown, but but he lays on me. There's nothing that he does for the takedown. Mm-hmm. And he throws a punch here and there, but I don't believe he throws over 10 punches in from the last 18 minutes.
Yeah. You had to retire after that fight due to injuries. Then a couple of years later, the UFC became huge, in part due to the larger-than-life personalities of people like Tito Ortiz and Ken Shamrock, and then, of course, the Ultimate Fighter explosion. Given that few have a bigger personality than yours, do you ever look back on your time in the UFC and wonder what could have been if you didn't have to retire?
No, you know, when I came back in 2006, I was training with all the top guys, and I didn't do anything for 3.5 years. I had literally like 7 or 8 weeks to prepare for that fight, you know, and I didn't live a healthy life for those 3.5 years, let me tell you that. So from zero, I couldn't do the warm-up. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I started that fight. But then like 6 weeks in, I was sparring with guys in Vegas, and you know, I didn't need the minute break. I didn't even take anymore. I said, keep on coming. And I would switch opponents the whole time. And everybody goes like, man, this is crazy. You should, you know, you got to go start back going back to a title. I said, but the problem is that it's my knees. They were both blown up already. I had my tendonitis back. And the tendonitis is killing you. It's so painful. You lose weight from the pain because you can't eat. And that constantly, it's 2 times a day. Every time you train, after like 45 minutes, an hour, it hits you, and then like an hour and a half, you're in intense pain. It's not fun anymore, you know, that kind of training, I don't want to do anymore.
No, so we won't see a boss come back for a one-off in the UFC in the future, a Legends bout or anything like that?
No, that will never happen.
Having too much fun talking about it, right?
The thing is, if they give me like cartilage on my knees, and I have my new cartilage on my knees, and I find a way to work around my tendonitis, well, then you never know. Because I know that within 3 months, I can be in a crazy shape. But the knees are also a big problem. Right now, there's nothing they can do about it, other than waiting for stem cell research. Like, hopefully, that's going to help in the future.
Good stuff. You then went back to Japan, where you became the color commentator for Pride Fighting. You seem like a total natural in the booth. Was the transition from fighter to commentator as easy for you as it appeared to be?
You know, it was the funniest thing, because what happened was that I was in the dressing rooms before the fights, and we were watching the fights there. I was there with Mark Kerr. I was his coach at the time. Mm-hmm. And we were watching fights, and I go like, oh, look at this. He's going for an armbar. Now watch this. And then I said, wait for it. Boom, yep, there's the armbar. So they look at me. And nothing's been said, but I saw them look like a crazy look there. And the next fight was also a fight, and it was in I think it was Sakuraba and Carlos Newton, and I just knee-barred Carlos Newton. He attacked me for fun in an interview, and I knee-barred him during that interview. So I tell Newton, I say, you got to watch out for knee-bars, because Sakuraba is good with that. And I see them rolling, and right away I see Sakuraba setting him up. So I go like, there's a knee bar coming, you know. And like 5 seconds later, boom, there was a knee bar. So these people go like, holy shit, how you do this? I said, you can see the setup. He said, man, did you ever think about commentating? And that's how I got the job. Then suddenly, you know, the next show I was there as a commentator. I didn't even know I had to bring a suit. That's why we had those crazy little clips that the Quadros and I did.
Right.
You know, the first one, I'm sitting there with the girls with the grapes, and I'm sitting in my shirt and my shorts. That was how I actually went to the show. They go like, you didn't bring a suit? I said, nobody told me. I had no food.
In that time, you worked with people such as, like you said, Quadros, and briefly Damon Perry. But the pairing most people seem to remember is you and Mauro Ranallo. For my money, it was one of the greatest announced teams the sport has ever seen. We had Mauro on as a guest recently, and he had nothing but great things to say about you and that time in his career. What gave you guys such great chemistry?
You know, we had that chemistry from day one. We shot in a TV show, and a movie together. Like a really bad movie, and we were commentators in that movie. And I came in there, and we had like scripts. Both had a script. It was like 6-page script we had to do. And I had a hangover because I was partying all night. And he came in, and I looked at it for the first time. And he was big at that time. He was like 30 pounds heavier. So, but anyway, we started talking, and it clicked right away. And suddenly he throws down his script, and he goes like, "Okay, let's do it." And I go like, "What? You got it?" And he says, "Yeah, I got it." So I start throwing the lines with him, doing lines with him, and he had every single line. And I go, holy crap, this guy did that. in like 5 minutes, he memorized like 6 pages. So we hit it off. We start doing, we do a lot of improv, and it just went really good. So I go, man, you're an unbelievable talent, I told him. I said, give me your number. You never know, you know, if I ever have, you know, somebody needs a commentator, mm-hmm. I would love to you to have that job. And then 4 years later, then when they fired Quarters, they asked me, do you know somebody? I say, actually, I hope that the telephone number still works. And then I called Mauro and left a message. And that was cool because he was in a really bad period of his life. Mm-hmm. And that totally pulled him out. And I told him after the first two shows working with him, I said, man, you're going to be on the list as best commentator. You watch. You're going to be the number one dog. Because he's just really, really talented. And that's the same as Kenny Rice. Right. Kenny Rice and Mauro also, the things they do on Inside MMA, people think they use a prompter. He doesn't use a prompter. They're like, even the guests are looking at each other and they go, oh, what is he doing? It's all on top of his head, and he doesn't make any mistakes. It's very methodical what they do. He does like 6 other sports also, and Mauro also. Whatever you give to him, he can do it. It's crazy.
Mauro's a walking encyclopedia of MMA. It's almost astounding just to be around the guy sometimes.
You cannot believe it. You cannot. I have the crazy stories with Mauro. I had, this story is the funniest ever. We go out to dinner with the head, remember the head of Pride, you know, Saki Kabara,
a lot
of people. So we were the new commentating team. So he said he took us out to dinner, or lunch during the day. So this is the first time I see Mauro in 4 years. He lost 30 weights. He's totally changed, you know, but he's got the same voice, same everything. And so we hit it off right away again. And he's always walking around with his notes. You know, he has notes under his arm and his pen.
Right.
And suddenly we're walking on the street and we hear, and we look back, and Mauro has his T-shirt like tucked in from the above, you know, like that looks like you have a bra.
Okay.
And his glasses are half on his face, and he's walking around like he's crazy, like just screaming. So these Saki Kabara, he looks at me and goes, what is this, you know?
Right.
Then we went to dinner, and after dinner, after we ate, suddenly he gives me his notes, and he puts his pen on top, and he puts his glasses on top, and he starts making somersaults over the floor. And he goes like, I'm not kidding, he goes like 25 yards, and he goes around the corner. And everybody looks at each other, and we go like, whoa, what is going on? And the Saki Kabara, everybody got afraid, you know. They go like, is he okay? Is this
what are we spending our money on here?
Unbelievable. But then, you know, the light goes on, and then you have a Mauro Ranallo who never messes up. It's unreal.
Yeah. Oh, I wonder, what was Saki Kabara's reaction to that? You know, someone on his payroll all of a sudden just appears to lose their mind right in front of them.
They were in shock. I was in shock because the first time when he did the thing, that I go like, oh, you know, he's just crazy. But then when he started making somersaults, you know, now I'm getting worried, and I vouched for the guy. I didn't see him for 4 years. I don't know what goes on in his crazy mind, you know. But that's just Mauro. It's the funniest thing. The stories that I have with him, he's the best. I love the guy a lot. He's one of the greatest guys out there. Trust me.
Absolutely. Looking back on the Pride era, what was your favorite fight to call? You were there at ringside for so many great moments. So looking back, if you had to pick one, what were you just, you know, I can't believe I'm here for this kind of thing?
The Krokop Fedor fight. That was the way they presented that. And what America didn't see was this entrance clip footage that they had of Krokop. Him training in like a really nice brand new facility, but then those images, they got disturbed with like corpses, dead people floating in a river in the winter, like snow on the side. They see corpses going through the, and that was just how his father died or something. There was something going on there.
Holy moly.
Then you go from there, it went to Fedor, it went back and forth, and Fedor is like running in the snow, like Rocky, and training with these old equipment things. And then it goes back to Krokop, and he's hitting, kicking these beautiful bags. Boom, boom, high kicks. And again, all those dead bodies, and then suddenly he's sitting in front of a grave, his father's grave, and it goes back to Fedor. I mean, when Krokop came up, he had tears in his eyes. He was very emotional. That wasn't crazy experience, that fight. That was awesome.
Well, the Japanese production teams really go all out, don't they?
All the way. I ask them constantly. I say, why do they not show this in America? I mean, they're gonna love this. I have no clue why that is.
Get is Chael Sonnen trash talking. That's the best we get.
Well, he does that really well.
Yeah, he does. I'll give him that much. You left Pride in 2006. Was it due to seeing that the ship was sinking? Was it due to Jerry Millen? What was the decision-making process?
No, we can't blame anything. Not that on Jerry Millen. He made dumb mistakes, and he just copied what other people did. You know, he had no talent whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But what was really going on is that, you know, the people, there was this big thing that the Yakuza was involved with Pride.
Right.
And when that happened, Tokyo TV or TV Tokyo or whatever.
Fuji TV, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, Fuji, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they said, okay, we don't broadcast you anymore. And that was a big moneymaker, for what I understand. Mm-hmm. And when that fell out, then the people suddenly realized, wait a minute, if we go to these events, we're kind of supporting the Yakuza. So that's how it started, I think. That's when it started going slowly but surely down. They start making crazy decisions, you know. Mm-hmm. Like you said, hiring a guy who had no clue what he was doing, and then, you know, it was heartbreaking. It was really heartbreaking. And I told them 5 years before all that, you know, all the way in the beginning, I said, you got to go to America. You got to go to America. We got to get an in America. No, because we're making good money here and everything's good. I say, Japan is great, Japan is big, I said, but it's nothing is like America. That's where the big bucks are, you know?
Right.
But they kept holding it off, and I told them all that. I said, go to the meetings. No, and I went to the meetings, the Athletic Commission meetings, and nothing happened. And I'm begging them. I said, let me talk. I'll go there. But they didn't do it, and at the end, they finally let me. And I had, the Athletic Commission was turned. Like, they decided there, right there, after I did my speech, he says, well, we're splitting hairs here. It's okay. Boom. And suddenly they were legal. But now it was way too late. They should have done that 3 years earlier. You know, now the UFC was already big. It's very hard to catch up with the UFC. It's just a rock.
Sure, they had that Fedor-Mark Holman fight in Vegas, but it appeared to be almost too little too late at that point.
That's it. That's what I mean, you know. And a lot of people, I think they're so big in the UFC fans, they say, no, we're not going to support them. Mm-hmm. And then you had the real Pride fans that were there, but they had 6,000 people in the audience. Yeah. And then what I heard is like the pay-per-view was like ridiculous, like 60,000 or something. I don't know, but I heard that it didn't do good at all.
No, you know, they also went in without having any real television presence as well. Meanwhile, you got people watching the UFC every week. You know, it just seemed like a no-win situation for them at the time.
Yep.
Yeah, we mentioned Mark Kerr before. You appeared in the amazing HBO documentary, The Smashing Machine. You were coaching Kerr at the time. Were Kerr's drug problems and his demons, were they apparent to you then?
You know, I found that out after I was worked out with Mark and Marco Huas, and he was always sweating, and I didn't know why that was. And like when he didn't do anything, he was sweating. And I started training with him, and my tendonitis hit in my arm, and because I have to really use all the power that I have with these two guys. I mean, Huas and Kerr.
Yeah, big boys.
It was killing me. And it got so bad that I said to Kerr, I said, I want to go to the hospital now. I say, I cannot hold this. I can't hold this. This is too much now, the pain. You know, and I was literally, it was insane. Pain was insane. And he packed his bags. He says, to the hotel right now. Mm-hmm. And he says, boss, I take care of you. And we go to the hotel. He goes to his room, and he takes out a syringe, and I go, whoa, 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 whoa. He says, boss, trust me on this. I said, fuck it. You know, I mean, I was so in pain. And he shoots me up, and I go, whoa. I'm like a plant. I go, like, holy. But the pain was gone right away, and I started sweating. And I looked at him, and I say, now I know, you know. And I said, now I know what's going on. And then I start talking to him, like, you got to stop this stuff. And but that's how I found out. And I go, like, how can you even compete on this? I couldn't move. It was the way, it was new pain. And apparently it's a painkiller, but it's like the one step lower than morphine. So.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, not something you want to form a habit with, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You went on to coach a team in the IFL and then eventually became VP of Fighter Operations there. How did you become involved in the IFL?
Well, they called me, and they couldn't get a hold of me. There was an organization who were going to take care of the fighters, and they're going to pay them good, and we're here aiming for the fighters every time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I said, I heard this 50 times.
Sure.
I said, I'm not going to react anymore. It's every time the same thing, and then the fighters get screwed in the end. So I didn't, and people start calling me. Other people, they say, you have to do something. You have to call these people. They're for real, boss. So then finally, you know, I said, okay, I'll take the call. So I took the call, and he started talking, and that was Kurt Otto, and he sounded really sincere, and like he was real, and he was,
mm-hmm.
you know. So we had a meeting, and we started talking, and bada bing, bada boom, we're enrolled. I thought this is a great project, you know. We got to get stocks in the company, you know. The fighters were going to be taken care of, you know, in a good way. Mm-hmm. They were going to actually that if they're going to get injured, they were going to pay for it, and all those things they actually did also.
Right.
So they lived up to their word. It was a great company, but they saw it go so fast up that they start spending ridiculous money. Suddenly they needed to be in a bigger apartment in the middle of New York, where the most expensive spot, and hiring people had no clue what they were doing. You know, why are you here? Why? But apparently they thought they really needed that, and, you know, the money went, yeah. It was gone. It didn't work out anymore. It's a shame.
So is overspending that ultimately brought down the IFL?
Yes. Yeah. I think so. That was one of the biggest things. It's, you know, and then we got, what's his name again? The head of the IFL.
Jay Larkin,
in that interview saying that for him, MMA fighters on the floor, it's like two gay guys on the floor. And I go like, okay, you're really a moron now. I mean,
not the best way to promote the company, that's for sure.
The head of the company, what are you doing? Yeah. You know, you should love mixed martial arts. Yeah, needless to say, he was there for the money and for nothing else. And right away, people start picking that up. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's, yeah. A bad thing. That was a bad thing. That thing with Dana, nobody can say that. If somebody lost mixed martial arts, well, it's him, you know. And he did a really good job for everybody. And a lot of people owe works to him, including me, because mixed martial arts got so big, I got to have my own show to talk about it. So,
yeah, not too bad.
Yeah, you know, got to give him props. Props to the people who deserve it.
Absolutely. You also coached Kimbo Slice for a brief time when he was entering MMA. What was it like working with Kimbo?
Kimbo was great. It was great. He was in the beginning. He was very hungry. He came in. He really wanted to learn, and you know, and picked up fast. But then, you know, then he would do a fight, and after the fight, you just go home and don't do anything. And then when they would call him 5 months later for another fight, he said, "Oh, he picked up the phone," and then he would come back to me again, and then started training. And you know, at that time, he should have been training, mm-hmm. and I told him that, but he didn't do that in the beginning, but then he came back and everything went good again, and his mind was there. And I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. I don't know if he started believing the group around him, the people around him or something. And, you know, I actually showed him one time that he wasn't there yet, you know, that really we had to, you know, he just needs to focus and he needs to be there. And, he, you know, it was painful in my knee. I cannot do this. I have to go somewhere there, you know, get a cortisone shot for him, you know, x-rays from his knee. My friend is a knee surgeon. All the nice problems that he had in the Ultimate Fighter, we knew that. We knew exactly what was going on.
Yeah.
And because he had to drain his knees the whole time because they were blowing up. So we knew his career was not probably going to last. But then I think along the way, what happens is that, you know, you get suddenly so famous and everybody recognizes you. And sometimes, you know, that does something to somebody. I don't know.
Do you think the fame went to his head? Because even housewives out there know who Kimbo Slice is, even though he's not the most, you know, not the greatest fighter, certainly. But like you said, the most recognizable, maybe.
For sure. That, you know, and I don't know who went to his head. I don't know what. But, you know, showing up late, very disrespectful, I told him also. And then, you know, then once you start doing things like that and you know, comments that he made after a fight when he lost, and I go, okay, I don't want to, you know, I don't believe in him anymore. I don't respect him anymore. And once that I told him this, I had a sit-down with him, And I told him everything what I thought about him. And I said, yeah, I lost my respect. There's no respect anymore. And I can't train people with that. It doesn't matter what kind of money. Oh, also that was also funny. People go, oh, boss is doing it for the money. I lost money training Kimbo.
You lost money on Kimbo?
Yeah, because, you know, what do I get? I get 10%. Let's say he made 100 grand for his first, like, four fights. Mm-hmm. It's 100 grand. 10% is $10,000. But I trained together with another guy. Now, since everybody says, oh, you got to pay this guy $100 an hour. No, we're buddies. We're split straight to the middle. So in 6 weeks, you get $5,000. Whoa, that's a big number, right? And then, on top of that, I told him, I said, listen, if a commentating job comes up for me, I have to go away for a few days because I have to, you know, I got to make money also. And that was no problem. But then a commentating job would come up, and I felt kind of bad, so I would say no to the commentating job, stay with Kimbo, train with him. But now I lost money, you know. Mm-hmm. So then at the end, thank God, the last fight, he got a whole bunch of money for that. And, you know, that I think it straightened it out. But mm-hmm. I don't think I ever made money on that.
What, was that the CBS fight with James Thompson?
Yeah. No. That was the one with...
Tank?
No, the last fight. Petruzzelli.
Oh, the very last one. Oh, okay. The 14-second wonder.
That's it. Because what happened was Shamrock got out, and he was the main event. Mm-hmm. So now, Mike, I see Mike, his manager, great guy, by the way. His whole group, by the way, the Kimbo's group, yeah. I had the best time in my life, and these guys are awesome. It's really funny. They're really funny guys. And he started negotiating, and he started asking astronomical, high numbers. Can't even say the word in English. And I told him, I said, you're never going to get it. He says, we are going to get it. He says, because he's the main event, they're going to need him. And sure enough, man, they got so high. And that was the moment and I didn't see any footage. I saw one fight on Petruzzelli really fast there. Mm-hmm. You know, and where he fought like a slop of a guy, and he didn't look that good.
Right.
But if I would have known, you know, that like after the last fight that I saw from him in the UFC, mm-hmm. you know, if I would have seen that fight, I would have never let him fight. I mean, gee, he's a Terminator. Okay, he lost his last fight then, but
no, it definitely put some heart into it. That's for sure.
Oh yeah, he's really good. Really good. Very impressive.
You seem to pop up everywhere, movies, TV, even video games. You had your own segment in Grand Theft Auto 4 called The Men's Room, I believe. How did you wind up in the game?
You know, the person who made that clip of me on the internet, on YouTube, with the bar fighting one.
Right, yeah.
That guy, and I tried to reach him. I tried to contact him because everybody, pretty much all the work that I had is because of that. They see that clip. Mm-hmm. They say, man, this guy is funny. Yeah. And then they ring the bell. Suddenly they contact my website. Bada bing, bada boom, and they're there. So that's exactly how it happened. They saw that and they said, "Man, can you do? Can you do something crazy here? Asking me to do something crazy." That's like
funny enough. I think they got it.
Yeah, I can be myself.
Yeah. Is there any chance you'll show up in another GTA game or anything else like that in the future?
Yes, actually there is. I'm in a new EA Sports game and. And I'm just off the phone just before you with another gaming company. And in the game, I'm going to be myself also, for what I understand. Bossroots, it's an online game that you can... Yeah, an online game, so like a war game. But I don't have the details on it. I don't even know if I can talk about it. But that I'm going to do also. But it's like a five-day shooter here, so... I have no clue what it is, but it sounded cool.
Good enough for me.
Yeah.
As we mentioned, everyone seems to love that Boss Rutan street fighting self-defense tape. Any chance you'll release another to spread more pearls of wit and wisdom on the world?
You know what? I do think that I will do something, but I'm going to wait a little bit with it. Right now, I'm working with the Cartoon Network, with the kids. And I will start an anti-bullying campaign now. And we also got that deal last week. And I really going to enjoy that. And, of course, this is not teaching him how to fight. This is like teaching him how to stay away from the fight, you know, and do it the right way. So I don't
think so the anti-bullying campaign is a little different from the street fighting self-defense is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. If these people, if the parents start Googling me, they're going to go like, holy, this guy is crazy. It is the funniest ever.
We've all heard, you know, some of the legendary Boss Hurtin' Party stories, facing down a bunch of bouncers, the stare down with Brian Urlacher and things like that. Has there ever been a time when you thought, wow, this is too crazy even for me?
No. It's really weird when something like really bad goes on or something, then it's like, it's really weird. There is this feeling that I have that I'm always okay. Mm-hmm. I will almost at that moment when people would shoot me and I'll take the bullet, I'm so confident I will say I'll survive that. It's really weird. It's the coolest experience always. but then later on when you see what you did, you're gonna go like, oh wow, you know. Yeah, that was kind of crazy. Last time I was Valide Ismail, the fighter. You remember him?
Yeah.
Now, he was in my dressing room after the fight against Randleman, and I blew my nose, so my eyes were both closed, all blown up with blood, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm laying there, and I say, we're going to go out. And everybody says, yeah, you can go out. I said, oh, really? And I got my doctor is there. And I say, hey, give me a syringe with a white valve. I needed something white. So I get it, and I go to the mirror, and I open my eyes with it, and I stab the needle, and I start sucking out the blood. I do the other eye, sucking out the blood, and I go like, okay, put the shades on. I say, come on, guys, let's go. And later on, I'm standing somewhere, and I hear Valide Ismail telling that story to a dude, and then you go like, yeah, that was maybe kind of crazy, you know, when four people... If they see that, the way everything goes, because, you know, of course, you stand there with a Heineken and everybody's funny and it goes really. So it's normal at the moment to do stuff like that, but it's...
It's the benefit of hindsight is what gets you.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't know. But we had some great stories. I knocked out a WC, yeah, in Holland, I can't know how I say it, toilet, in Honolulu. Mm-hmm. And I slipped in the bathroom, and I arched backwards with my head. I hit the toilet, and it exploded in like 150 pieces. It was gone. I pulled the sheets from the bed there because I had two beds. I start kicking it there in the hole, and I just go to sleep. The next day, I wake up, and I go, man, did I dream this thing? You know, were there people in my room? And I hear the toilet, and I go, So I go in the bathroom. And I always sit down when I pee in the morning. So I sit down, boom, and I lean over and I flip the switch on. And this whole place looks like there's blood everywhere and bloody handprints all over the place. And I go, oh, my God, you know. So I jump up and I look in the mirror and I got nothing on my face, right? I go, what happened? So I start running through the window, through the room. I'm opening the balcony. I said, did I kill somebody? Did I throw somebody out of the balcony, you know? I had no clue what to do. And now the security calls. They said, we're going to come up. So I go, okay, well, yeah, come up. So they come up, and there's this beautiful girl. I open the door, and she looks at me and says, hey, how you doing? We're talking. And she sees a picture of me, like a signed picture with El Wapo says dance, it says. And then you see me like in the 70 close with like a big smile with a bling on my teeth, you know. It's a funny picture. And she says, is that you? I say, yeah. She says, oh, that's a funny picture. I say, okay. I say, hey, what's going to happen here? She says, oh, my boss is very, very angry. He says, I think she's going to be in trouble. I said, really? Yeah. I said, well, we'll see. So now the guy comes on the hallway. We hear him. Rah, 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 we hear something. And he turns around the corner, and she's like in shock. And he looks up at me, and he goes, Boss Rosen, oh, my God, big fan. So I go, hey. So I go down. Everything was good, of course. It was erased right away. And now I was there on a bodybuilding show or like a fitness show. And I'm sitting having breakfast in the morning. And these guys are happy because all their breakfasts are comped. And I say, why is your breakfast comped? And they say, yeah, because some idiot let some water go out of his room or something. And the whole 38th floor started floating. So everybody's luggage started to get wet, and I go look at him. I go like, I think I was that idiot. Are you on the 38th floor? Yeah. I said, that was me.
Well, at least you got him a free breakfast out of the whole deal.
It was the craziest thing. I brought a piece of that hotel or the hotel of the toilet. I brought it home with me. It was the craziest thing. You could not do it with a sledgehammer. It was the wildest thing ever.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Now you're doing Inside MMA on HDNet. You seem to be having a lot of fun with that. Who are your some of your favorite fighters just to talk to?
Oh man, you know, there's so many. Jimmy Varner, I always like, because he's really open. Like Forrest Griffin was just on the show for a night. Sean Jones. Oh man, so many of them. They're great guys. The way Tito was on our show and how he talked about Matt Hamill, that was awesome stuff, you know. And you know, now the last show I had also, that was good. Talked about the UFC. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the greatest job. Why? Because I see a lot of old buddies of mine. Yeah. And on the other side, I see a lot of new talent that come to the show, and I got them. I'll have fun with those guys.
Yeah. Who's one of the up-and-comers in the cage that is on Boss Rutten's radar nowadays? Who's a young guy that you just love to watch?
What's his name? John Jones, of course.
Sure.
That's Rory McDonald.
Yeah, Rory McDonald, oh, BC's own friend of the show.
Yeah, I think that kid is going to go big also. Oh, man, yeah. I mean, now, right now, Hominick is like Mark. Hominick is made that whole transition, is really good on the ground now, too, and his striking is just off the chart. I think he'll explode. Him, the fight between him and Alves, that should be something.
Yeah, that'll be a barn burner. Definitely.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're a star of stage and screen, as it were. You know, you're a multimedia man with the video games. What's next for Boss Rutten? Is there any plans maybe to do a book of your life? You have so many amazing stories, or even a late-night talk show. I'd watch that.
Yeah, that would be funny. No book. I said a while ago, you know, they're not going to believe it anyway. The stuff that I did, you know, and even the funny stuff, they're not going to believe it. And some of the stuff, you know, you go like, okay, I never did like the illegal things, like crazy things, you know, but it's just crazy stuff. And I don't know if it's good to put that crazy stuff in a book and let other people read it, and especially my kids, if they're going to read it and they're going to do something, they're going to go, yeah, you can't say anything. You did that, you know, so let that be. Maybe when I'm very old, I'll do something like that. You know, very old, or when I get over 60 or something, maybe something like that. But I had no desire to do that. And what I do have a desire for is like my life in the global way, maybe to make something out of that, like a screenplay. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because I was a sick kid, and you know, and the way everything got together is kind of cool. I don't know. I'm just doing like commercials, and now again that then a new video game, and I'm working on TV stuff, and hopefully something of that's going to hit. We made a couple of pilots, and they seem to really like it, the people. But you know, it's the person who says yes and sign at the dotted line. That's what I want to do. And at that moment when that happens, then I'm one of the luckiest men ever out there, which I am already actually, because I'm doing what I love to do. What the people say, you know, there's nothing better than when your hobby is your job, and that's my case.
Yeah, when we talked to Krzysztof Soszynski, he said he couldn't get over that you were the most positive man that he's ever met in his life. What gives you that kind of great attitude going through day to day in an admittedly violent sport?
You know, I think everything is too serious. I always said, you know, I was that. Yeah, like I said, the sick kid in class. I was always the happiest in class and the most annoying one in class. And you know, I always saw the big things, the big picture. The glass is always half full with me. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. Maybe I have it for my dad, or I just really enjoy it and enjoy life. And I think life is beautiful. People should enjoy it. You know, I hate people with like who are angry in the morning. You know, wake up. Mm-hmm. I could never live with a person like that. You know, you're going. They look at you. They talk. I hate people who are working behind the desk of whatever place. It doesn't matter, and are not polite to you. You know, those kind of things. I just simply can't stand. I don't like people cutting in lines and think they're better than other people. You know, we're all the same. Nobody's better than you. Because I drive a bigger car, now suddenly I'm going to take the right away. You know, and that's when that happens. And I'm in the neighborhood, I'm going to save the day. And it's always like that. I'm the guy in the movie theater when somebody is on the phone. I will be the first guy to say, turn their freaking phone off, you know, and because nobody else is doing it. I cannot believe that. You know, so rude. Some people are so rude. And I just try to see and bring life to people, make people happy, let them see how life is really is.
Well, you ought to spend more time up here in Canada than Boston. We're a nation of very polite people, they tell us.
I know that. Yeah, I heard that. And that I really enjoy. It's, you know, I went back to Holland, and then you realize, yeah, that's, you know, it's different. Like, right away, I go somewhere at the airport, and this old woman comes in, and nobody stands up. And I go, and I'm standing, too, and I go to somebody, I look at the people, and I say, really? Really, nobody gets up here? And then, then they realize, you know. I go, wow, nobody sees that. They just don't mind. And, yeah. That rule that everybody knows, treat people like you want to be treated,
right.
That's really what I want to do. And that's a very cliche role, but that's really how I live.
El Wapo says, be polite, kids.
That's it.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today, boss. I really do appreciate it. Anything else you want to plug on the way out?
On the way out, bodyactionsystem.com. Mm-hmm. Check that website out. And for the rest, I'm working with some really great people on the internet. We're going to do some crazy stuff, and I think, well, everybody in the world will hear stuff like what we're going to do. I'm going to come out with a new training device. It's a long training device, and the results that the people are having now, right now in the university, we're testing it, are really good. And but you will hear that. It will explode, and that's about it. My website, just check out my website, boston.com, And you'll be updated.
Excellent. All right, thank you so much, El Wapo, Boss Rutan on In the Cage with Bards.
UBC Rec is everything that is recreation on campus. No matter how you play, UBC Rec is your resource for fun activities. This student program is operated by over 140 volunteers, and it is the largest intramural recreation organization in Canada. Programs cover fitness, instructional classes, outdoor recreation, drop-in sports, special events, small tournaments, and intramural leagues. All the registration information is available in the Student Recreation Center or online at rec.ubc.ca. UBC Rec, how do you play?
Well, that's about it for this time on In the Cage with Bards. Thanks again to Boss Rutan. An unbelievably entertaining guy, unbelievably nice, sincere, and positive guy. I really appreciate him taking the time to indulge me in my many questions. Also want to remind everyone that for local MMA, the Battlefield Fight League will be hosting the biggest MMA event ever held in Richmond, BC on Saturday. Headlined by UFC veteran and friend of the show, Caleb Starnes, taking on Nick Hinchliffe in a grappling exhibition. And also the headlining will be Gary Manjat and Chris Day clashing at 140-pound catchweight bout. Flashy Nick saying Capoeira expert Marco Cafiero, top prospect Matt Dwyer, Excite Fights number one ranked middleweight Levi Alford, fan favorite Sean Zubor, and Universal MMA's Ash Mastrini. I'm sorry, I butchered that last name. Sorry, dude. And just some of the exciting fighters on the card. A huge local show. I'll be there. You should be too. It's at the River Rock Casino in Richmond, and definitely come out and support local MMA Saturday night. And that's the view from here. Until next time, you have been In the Cage with Bards.
The UBC Learning Exchange Trek program wants you to get involved in your community. Learn about important